Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about human trafficking, a crime that's growing around the world and right here in Iowa. And I want you to be aware that we will be talking about disturbing subject matter this hour that may not be appropriate for all listeners. Later in the hour, we'll talk about efforts to fight human trafficking in Iowa and information about how to protect yourself or your children from this heinous crime. But first, I'm going to talk with a survivor. Amber Causey ran away from home when she was 13 years old, and she became the victim of a human trafficker. She was one of the few that made it out. She joined the Army and had a distinguished military career. She now has a master's degree in criminal justice, and she's hoping her story can help others. She's also competing to become Miss Veteran America 2017, and she is here with me now. Hello, Amber.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And I want to go back in time to when you were a 13-year-old girl. You'd had a really difficult childhood. What led to you leaving home?
My mother was incarcerated when I was 13. And up until then, we grew up in a pretty sheltered household altogether. And I was separated from all of my siblings at that point. I was forced to leave my friends behind, leave the school behind, and move to a completely different area in Chicago with my father, who I had never had a relationship with. And going to a new school, not getting along with other females there, it became a burden. It was just so much going on in my life, so much change that I didn't know how to adjust to. And I started to, like, withdraw into myself. I had my first suicide attempt at 13. It was so overbearing. I couldn't handle all of the emotions that were weighing me down, and I didn't have anybody to talk to, anybody who would sympathize with what was going on with me or any of my siblings. And from there, I would leave out and act like I was going to school and not go to school at all because at first, you know, that was supposed to be an escape for me, and now I was going there and having to deal with more. And I completely dropped out of school completely. And when my father found out, and he kind of threatened me to, if I go up here and find out you haven't been going to school, you know, he was going to physically discipline me. And though he's never put his hands on me, I had spent the first 13 of my years being abused by my stepfather. So that triggered, you know, it for me, it was enough to just scare me. And I just ran and was on the streets at that point.
Wow. So 13 years old, living on the streets in Chicago.
I was actually 15.
15 by then.
Yes.
Okay. And living on the streets, I mean, at 15 years old, such a vulnerable age, a very young woman, a small woman, mm-hmm. living on the streets. When did you come into contact with the man who forced you into prostitution?
Yes. I was actually 16 when I came into contact with him. So between 15 and 16, I spent a lot of time house hopping from people that I did keep in contact with from school, and even meeting total strangers on the street, you know, that would offer me, hey, you can stay here, you know, two or three nights. You know, my aunt's not going to mind. So I came in contact with him at a mall. Like during the daytime, if I needed just somewhere to be and not want to be out on the streets, it was cold. It was the wintertime. I met him at a mall.
Wow. What did he say to you?
He approached me and he kind of groomed me, I would say. Like, he appeased to me as my knight in shiny armor. Like, he could save me, you know. He could provide me home, food, and shelter. And he groomed me in a sense that made me believe that he and I could be together and he would take care of me. He was rescuing me from the life that I was experiencing, trying to survive on the streets and from place to place at this point.
During that time, leading up to this moment, had there been moments where someone had almost been able to help you? It's so heartbreaking to think of you going from home to home, this young woman. Did people try to help?
No. And I wish, you know, I think that's what kept me on the move, because I would be at, you know, some friend's house and their parents, I could hear them like, well, why is she still here? Or I would hear them questioning it, you know, their child about it, but never coming to me and asking me or taking the time, well, let me reach out to her parents or anything like that. So up until that point, no. I mean, I was even picked up by the police at one time, and they took me back to my father's, and he was like, well, no, you can't come back here. I mean, so I just, at that point, I was lost in the streets and in the world.
So when this man approached you, he was one of the first who seemed to really offer substantial help.
I mean, and I can't even explain, like, I really believed that he cared. I honestly can't even remember up until that point in my life. And even after, you know, since I was 13, an adult, you know, someone in my life telling me that they loved me or that they cared about me. When I lost my mother, I lost all structure, all stability. I lost the only person who I felt like loved me as an adult. I lost all of that. So when he came offering me that, I was completely open to it. And I felt like he was my savior, like he was going to help me and take care of me. He wasn't judging me about being homeless, about not finishing school. And I didn't realize how naive I was being, but I definitely took him for his word. I didn't have many other options.
So he approached you. He was kind to you. He told you that he cared about you. How did this progress?
He would take me shopping, take me out to eat. He got me a cell phone. And I mean, honestly, I spent so much time with him just hanging around him. And he was like very well known. A lot of people knew him. So I kind of felt like I was important and like I was somebody when I was with him. And one day, you know, and I kind of started to suspect like maybe this isn't what I'm thinking it is, because at all this time we had never had any sexual intercourse.
Right.
So one day, you know, when we were finally heading to his place, because I had never been to his place, his house before. And one day we were heading there and I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is it. He took his time with me. You know, he's really a gentleman. And I get there and there are other women and girls there. And, you know, that's when I realized, okay, I didn't question him or say anything. I kind of, you know, seeing other girls, I still didn't know what was going on. Still nothing was said to me that night. And he got up and left the next day. And it was the girls who told me, like, you know, this is what's going to happen. You either can fall in line and do this the easy way, or, you know, this is what they're going to do. They're going to take you where all these men are and rape you until you submit. And I mean, it was just one of them things where I'm like, okay, I have a home right now. Let me just try and do what I need to do, because obviously I'm not going to just walk out of this.
Did you consider trying to run away at that point?
Oh, yes, I did. I even initially thought that I had found a friend in one of the other girls. And, you know, together we kind of came up with a little plan. And the whole time she was kind of setting me up for him just to see where my mindset was, if I was fully in it or if I was still, you know, trying to get away or trying to escape. And so at that point, it kind of broke, you know, my hope of just trying, even, you know, being arrested as a minor for prostitution and thinking, okay, you know, this is it. Like, you know, they're arresting me. You know, they're going to call my parents or my family, someone, I'm a minor. And to leave out, you know, that courthouse the next day and he's there, it's like, you know, damn, I can't escape. You know, I can't. At that point, I kind of fully submitted into the lifestyle. And I'm like, okay, you know, this is it. Nobody's looking for me. You know, nobody cares. So
that seemed like the only thing you could do to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
You were really fully trapped. Tell me what life was like for you, if you can.
Every day was the same. There was no breaks. We were out on the streets from about 9 in the morning to 11 at night, midnight sometimes. Sometimes even later, if we had to do a party, putting up ads on the internet, on Backpage and stuff like that. And every, I mean, day was scary, like, because we split up. We're all in the same area, but it's not like, okay, I have this other girl with me. We're together. We can help each other. We're all split up, and we have to, you know, be out there on our own, approaching strangers or getting into cars with strangers who you don't know. I mean, it's a risk. There are men out there that are killing, you know, young girls and assaulting them. And so you kind of are scared, you know, you're riding around because you don't know if they're kind of just trying to flee from the police or if they're trying to find, you know, a dark spot somewhere where they can victimize you. And so every day it was like that. There was no breaks. Even when, you know, something happened to me, I found myself in terrible experiences. And, you know, I had to be right back out there the next day. There was no, okay, you know, this just happened. Everybody's going to come in. You're going to get a break. No, you had to be right back out there. You had to make, you know, a minimum amount of money to be able to come in off the streets, to be able to have something to eat. And when you're making, you know, anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000 a day, and you have to turn around and hand all that money over to a man, and the next day he only gives you $20 to go back out the next day with to buy condoms and food. And I mean, it's you kind of want to hope that maybe something will change, or I mean, it's no getting addicted to the lifestyle or the fast money or anything like that, because it's not ours. You know, we were nothing but a product that can be used over and over again.
Were there times when you felt like your life was at risk?
Yes. I had two situations in particular that I'm constantly thinking about. And there was one where we had guns pulled out on us and by some Russians. We were servicing some Russians. And there was a huge language barrier. But the young girl who was, like, in charge of all of us, she was 22 at the time when I met her. She had been in trafficking or in prostitution since she was 16. And she kind of like thrived in it, like would glamorize it sometimes. She felt like it empowered her. And I know now how brainwashed she was. But she set the date up for us. It was my first time meeting them. And it was about at least 12 men there. And I remember two women, I don't know if it was, it had to be one of their wives. And they were there, you know, just watching TV. And they seen us come in. They knew we were there. And it was almost as if we were just an appetizer for their husbands. It didn't matter.
And we're going to have to find out how that ended in just a moment. I'm talking with Amber Causey. She is a survivor of human trafficking. She had a distinguished military career in the Army. She has graduated with a master's degree in criminal justice. She's competing to become Miss Veteran America 2017. We'll talk about the pageant later this hour as well, and we'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about human trafficking. And with me right now is a survivor. Amber Causey was trafficked. She was forced into prostitution as a teenager after living as a homeless youth for a while. She managed to make it out. We'll talk about how she did that. She joined the Army. She had a distinguished military career. Today, she has one master's degree in criminal justice. She's working on another. She's hoping to go to law school. She's written a book that will be published maybe next year, I hope. She also has two wonderful children, and she's competing to become Miss Veteran America 2017. She also strongly believes that her story can help other people. And Amber, just before the break, we were talking about one of the times, and there were more than one time, mm-hmm. when you felt like your life was in danger, which is a very real reality mm-hmm. for young women who are forced into this position. A lot of young women die in this position. So you had been hired
yes.
by some Russian mm-hmm. men. There were a lot of men involved in this situation. It was a very strange situation. That they actually pulled out weapons on
yes,
you?
Yes. So they were beginning to be extremely overbearing. Me and a few other girls, you know, we looked so young, so we were very marketable in trafficking and in prostitution. And so me in particular, I was getting bombarded, you know, by several of the men, and it just became, you know, too overbearing. I'm like, okay, I can't do this. I was starting to break down. So the older woman who was with us, she had the money from them, and she ran out of there. So they drew guns on the rest of us.
And
and we barely, you know, made it out of there, but we did. They let us leave, and, you know, none of us got injured from that. But I had a situation in particular where I met a guy. It was late at night, and I knew that it was approaching the time where we would normally go in. I still hadn't made, you know, my minimum amount. So at this point, I couldn't be choosy. You know, if somebody was coming, I needed to just go with them, regardless of what they were willing to pay. Because eventually, you know, those small amounts start to add up. And there was this man in particular. He was in the van, and he kept circling. I noticed him circling several times. And some of them are weary about stopping because law enforcement, they are strict. They know, you know, us in those areas. They see us. Some of them, you know, if none of the businesses are calling and complaining, you know, they won't bother us. They would even actually speak to us, you know, sometimes. And almost as if, you know, they were out there just keeping an eye on us, making sure, you know, we were okay. But I ended up getting in a vehicle with him, and he was Hispanic, and he was speaking Spanish, but I could understand, you know, a little of what he was saying, and we were able to come up with an agreed-upon amount. So then he started to drive around. I'm thinking, you know, he's just looking for somewhere to park. And he's on the phone the entire time, and he's talking in Spanish, so I'm not really knowing what's going on. He's driving from alley to alley, and I'm like, okay, you know, you can stop here, or he keeps going. So at this point, you know, I'm starting to sense, okay, something isn't right. And I finally look over to the door and realize, you know, the handle's missing, and the lock to the door, it's missing. I can't roll the window down, nothing. So at this point, I'm terrified. And finally, he pulled behind this, like, factory. There was a few of the big semi-trucks, like the trailer parts, parked, and he pulled next to them. So I'm like, okay, you know, I'm thinking, you know, at this point, everything's going to be okay. He handed me the money, so I climbed into the back seat at this point. I'm like, okay, maybe I'm just overreacting. And in the middle of us, you know, starting, I can see him, like, he's getting agitated, and he reaches down in the back pocket of the passenger seat and pulls out a knife. And at this point, I'm naked from the waist down, and, you know, I'm like, okay, that was one of my first moments where my entire life just flashed right then and there. All I could think about was my younger brothers. Like, I figured if anything happened to me, at the very least, it would tear them up the most. And it's not like they were in a position, they're a lot younger than me, to do, you know, anything about it or help me or even understand, you know, where my life is and what's going on. But eventually, you know, he pushed me out of the van, and I'm sitting here, you know, just shaking. It's cold. I bend down and I'm watching under the trailers as he pulls, you know, down the lot, and he's getting ready to drive out. But then I see him hit the brakes and start to back up. And at that point, I just take off running, and I start banging on the doors of this factory. And some of the workers came and opened the door, and I just collapsed. And I was crying, and they went and got some clothes and covered me up and called the police, and they took me to the hospital and stuff. And that moment right there just shook me. It was hard for me to get back in a car with somebody, especially somebody who wasn't a regular. It just broke me.
That was a moment, though, when you were in touch with people that it feels like they should have been able to help you. I mean, you were arrested. That feels like another moment when someone should have been able to help you.
I was at the hospital and got examined and no.
So how did you get out? Very few women, very few girls who are in this position ever make it out. How did you do it?
From that particular incident, that was one of the last, like, really traumatic experiences that I had that shook me. And from there, I just became more of a liability. You know, I was willing to just take the beatings for not making the money that I was supposed to make, because I just couldn't do it. I physically, like, I was just gone mentally. I couldn't do it. And he let me go. You know, he finally realized, okay, you know what? She's done mentally. She's broken. And I was. I was. I mean, it was at that moment, it was no coming back from that for me. I would have rather been dead than to live, you know, that experience again with somebody new, you know, hoping or pleading with somebody for my life, I would have just rather been dead. I was numb at that point.
What led you to join the Army? How did you get from there to there?
I had actually, so I didn't drop out of high school until my sophomore year. And I actually had filled out an interest card when some recruiters came up there for like a career day. And so it wasn't until 2 years later that recruiter is like reaching out trying to find me. And when they did, you know, if I could have left, you know, that day or the next day, I would have left. I was like, you know, I have nothing keeping me here, nothing, you know, to look forward to in my future right now. Like, that waiting process, taking the test, I had no GED, I had no ID, no birth certificate, no social security card, no address. I had nothing. So that waiting process with him, you know, trying to help me and establish everything that I needed, it was depressing for me. I was so ready to go, and I didn't want anything to stop it. And then, you know,
and where were you staying during that time?
I was staying again from house to house, and I met someone too, and he was trying to help me out as well, and he was a police officer and a lot older than I was too, and it was funny because initially I lied to him about my age, but then he, you know, ran my name in the system and seen, you know, everything that came back with me being arrested for things like prostitution. And he listened to my story and he helped me as far as, you know, if I couldn't go stay here with my sister. My sister was 3 years older than I at the time. She was someone who became a ward of the state, was, you know, getting government assistance and stuff like that. But we've always had issues with our relationship, and her dating, you know, a guy who even tried to take advantage of me too. And it was like, okay, I knew that that wasn't somewhere I can stay consistently. So I'd be there for like 2 or 3 nights. And then, you know, this place, I was back to house hopping at that point.
When you finally got all the paperwork cleared and joined the Army, it was such a dramatic change in your life. And you're still carrying so much trauma at that point. But how did you cope with your new life in the Army?
It was definitely a hard experience because I had an issue from... I dealt with a lot of sexual harassment, you know, and issues in the military. And one incident in particular, I was only in training when, you know, a male superior non-commissioned officer who's supposed to be there instructing us touched me inappropriately. And then I reported it. And, you know, the military has their own sexual harassment and assault response program, and they didn't handle it the way that would have built my faith or my trust in the system at that point. And it kind of just showed me, because, you know, you look at the military with such respect and honor, and by all means, it is that, you know, I would never let a few people sour that experience for me, because the military definitely saved my life. But to come from all of that and realize soon on, okay, you know, it's kind of not that different. You know, I can't dehumanize these people. These are still people. They make the same mistakes everybody do, regardless of the uniform they're wearing. So for me, I tried to kind of stay under the radar initially, but I was immediately deployed straight out of training, and I was in an all-male unit at that point. So it was kind of hard. Being a young female and people thinking I'm attractive and making certain comments or thinking that they can just touch me and kind of, I guess, not speaking up, kind of withdrawing to myself or laughing it off sometimes because it's easier for me to do that instead of, you know, speaking up and speaking out about it. So it was definitely something where eventually I felt like I was forced to grow up sooner than I was, but I think in the military, it definitely helped me evolve into a woman more.
You also were finally in a position where you were being respected for your brain.
Yes.
And for the work you could do.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And I progressed really fast in the military, and that's something, you know, still to this day, my decision to leave was very tough decision for me, but I know it was the right choice. But I definitely think that I could have went a lot further. I could have had a bigger impact on female women, too. I think we have it so hard in the military today, and a lot of people don't understand that, and even harder, you know, as veteran women. And I've worked for some great people, directly for a two-star general at one point. And I was a newly promoted E5. I had only been promoted for 3 months, and I was selected over all of the E6s on that post to come work for him. So my work ethic is something I am very proud about, and I'm very passionate about. I put 110% into everything that I put out there just because I want to leave, you know, that impression. Like, they know that, you know, these boots are going to be hard to fill, you know, when I leave.
Right. Well, and you did thrive in that and had a distinguished career. You had to leave because you had a high-risk pregnancy. But you clearly became determined to pursue your or develop your brain, develop yourself, and pursue some very difficult goals. Like I said, you just got your master's degree in criminal justice. What are your career goals? What are you hoping to do?
I want to go back and help trafficking victims, help them secure justice. I think there for a long time there has been inconsistency when it comes to the sentencing of women for prostitution as opposed to the men who are trafficking them or the men who are paying for their services. And it's changing a lot now, but I've noticed because I've been studying criminal justice. I love studying the law since 2009. And it's something that I love. I love seeing how it changed. I would love to be able to influence, you know, policy and hope that I can help these girls, not just by sharing my story, but actually doing something to help them.
When you became a mom and had a daughter, you felt like you had put a lot of this behind you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your daughter that made you feel like you had to share this story?
Yes. Initially, you know, I came into the military and I just left my past in Chicago. You know, that was it for me. And I had, you know, little things that triggered certain things that made me think about it. But it definitely didn't have the impact that it had on me until I became a mom. I had, you know, no positive role models, and to it being a parent is something still that stresses me out to this day because I keep saying, okay, right now my goal is to make it to, you know, when she's 13, and then, you know, I can pat myself on the back and keep going because that's when I lost my mom. And it's hard for me sometimes to get so worried and caught up about the future and not just, you know, living in the moment, being a mom. And then I get stressed about it. I get angry and just get flooded with these emotions because I want to protect her. I don't want her to go through even a fraction of what I went through. I don't want anybody's child to go through that.
How did the idea of participating in the Miss Veteran America pageant come up?
Someone, so they were, I guess, marketing it on social media, and someone tagged me in it. And I'm like, no, you know, I'm not going to compete in a pageant because I don't look at myself and think pageant. You know, I have tattoos. I'm a mom. And I'm like, no, that's definitely not me. I can be a bit rough around the edges sometimes. I've been around so many military men. And I'm like, no, I am not this just glamour Barbie doll. It's not me. But then when I realized, you know, what the competition was doing and what they were trying to bring, the issues that they were trying to bring awareness to, one in particular is veteran women homelessness. And I'm like, wow, it just struck a nerve for me because when I left the military, it was a very drastic, you know, decision, and I didn't have a plan. So those first few months were a struggle for me. I can't even explain enough. I was about 8 months, and I still hadn't had my own apartment yet. So I was living with person to person again.
But this time with a baby.
Yes, and hotels, and I'm spending money, you know, using my credit card. I had no money coming in. Apartments denying me because I couldn't show them, you know, any type of proof that, okay, this is the money I have coming in. I can afford to pay my rent. I was getting bills from the VA system saying I didn't have authorization to go to the emergency room here or there because they sent me to labor and delivery, which they automatically do, you know, after a certain point. So I was just being hit with so many things, and I had this child on the way. I couldn't enjoy the pregnancy. I was battling, you know, my depression and my PTSD and having lapses in my care because I have all this going on. I have to go to Hawaii. I moved to Hawaii initially, following my heart. You know, I was in a relationship with my son's dad, and that didn't work out. So then I have to leave the VA system there, and I came here. And the VA system here has been so great to me. It scares me. You know, I don't want to leave Iowa because you hear all these horror stories. And I would love to go and be closer, like to my mom and my brother who live in Florida. But I'm just so scared to leave here.
Well, the pageant is coming up in October. And I'm sure that sharing your story already is helping a lot of people. You've written a book, which is going to be published in a year, Redemption for a Stolen Girl. And stay with us. We're going to talk more about this horrible crime and how way too common it is in just a moment. Amber Causey is here with me today, a true survivor and an inspiration. We're going to continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about human trafficking, and I've been talking with Amber Causey, who is a true survivor. She joined the Army and managed to escape the life that she'd been leading after she had been forced into prostitution as a teenager. She had a distinguished military career. She now has completed her master's degree in criminal justice. She's working on another master's degree and hoping to go to law school. She's written a book that should be published next year, Redemption for a Stolen Girl, and she's also competing to become Miss Veteran America 2017. And I want to bring somebody else into the conversation now. Teresa Davidson is president of Chains Interrupted, a Cedar Rapids-based nonprofit that works to fight and prevent human trafficking. Teresa, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Teresa, I know that you share this information with people a lot, but human trafficking feels like, for most of us in our safe lives, it feels like something that happens far away. And that's not the case. So tell me how big a problem we believe this is in Iowa.
Well, interestingly enough, I, too, started out thinking that it was more of an international problem. In fact, I started seeing this when I was an international missionary, and I would go over to Thailand or to Burma or Cambodia and see these things that were happening on the periphery of my medical clinics there. And I discovered that it was human trafficking, and I became outraged because there was no one doing anything about it, and I needed to come back and start teams and go over there and do something about it. Well, I came back and started doing research on how to go over there and discovered that, to my amazement, it was very prevalent here in America. And then I discovered, to my broken heart, that it was right here in Iowa and even in my hometown. And my hometown is a small town in Iowa. So it's not even just the big cities in Iowa, but it's literally everywhere. It's in the small towns. We had the Iowa Attorney General's office, someone there say, it's in every town in Iowa, and someone challenged him on that, and he said, fine, get me a map. So they got a map of Iowa, and he said, close your eyes, point to any town, and they pointed to Hills, Iowa. And you remember what happened in Hills, Iowa. They did a sting there, and within a couple of days had several arrests for a human trafficking ring, and he proved his point. It's everywhere if you just know what to look for and actually look.
Give me some of the statistics, and we don't know all the numbers,
yeah.
But what do we think? How big is this?
Well, statistics are really hard because it's very underground and very hidden. People, you know, so there is one objective study that was done by Creighton University that really is very helpful to us because, as Amber mentioned, Backpage.com, people are being sold on that every day. And so Creighton University took a look at just that one venue. There are 25 typologies of human trafficking out there, and just this one type and just this one website. They looked at that and discovered that there were 1,350 unique individuals posting for sex in Iowa alone every single month.
Wow.
And if you look at Cedar Rapids only, 300 every month.
Amber is kind of the textbook idea of someone who was at risk.
Yes.
A young woman who didn't have a place to go, who was living on the streets, surfing from couch to couch. Paint a broader picture for me. Who is most at risk to be victimized by human traffickers?
Sure. So there's a video out there by Breaking Traffic, another anti-human trafficking organization that does wonderful work. And I would highly recommend everyone trying to get a hold of that and look at it. It's 15 minutes. And it's called Any Kid Anywhere. And it's called Any Kid Anywhere for a reason, because Amber met her trafficker at a mall. And I know kids in high school who don't have the risk factors that Amber did that go to malls and are approached by these people. And everyone wants to fit in. Everyone wants to be loved. Everyone wants to be cared about. And every single teenager feels like they may have, you know, that need, you know. And so the ones that are the most at risk are ones that have self-esteem issues or trouble at home, huge risk factors being sexually assaulted in the past, physically abused, needing that kind of family. But literally, if you think of teenagers today, they all crave that attention. They all crave that being someone special. As she talked about, you know, he made her feel like she was so special and important when she was around him. Who doesn't love that? So it's every kid is at risk.
This pattern of grooming a young person and making them feel special, giving them special things, that's a very common pattern. The next step where they really become entrapped or enslaved is so hard to grasp. I mean, how does that happen? And in many ways, it can be almost as simple as taking away somebody's cell phone and taking away their power to communicate, right?
Yes. But first and most importantly is taking away their rightful thinking. So we kind of call it brainwashing and sometimes, but that's a label I don't necessarily like to use. But it's definitely the grooming process. They just get in their head, and as they are building themselves up to be the only one who cares, the only one who can provide, the only one who truly loves them, they're tearing down other relationships, other good relationships in these people's lives, and letting them know that they can't count on them. They can't rely on them. It's a mind game, and they trap them.
So I was going to say, even threatening them too, threatening to hurt, you know, the people that we care about or that we love.
Exactly.
So there are many young people. I mean, you don't have to be a 13-year-old or a 15-year-old. Young people particularly are at risk, even into their 20s, men
yes.
and women. What should we know? I'm not in that age group, but what should people know to protect themselves?
You're very right. The higher risk group is young people, but it can happen to anybody. I've met women that pulled up next to a car in a parking lot and were taken or manipulated in some way. So you just have to be very vigilant. I would definitely say that you have to educate yourself. There are a lot of resources on our website, books, movies, documentaries, letters, short things that you can read. We do presentations all the time. So if anybody would like us to come speak at their club, their church, their group, their organization, their business, we'd be happy to do that. We've done that a lot. But educate yourself and then start educating the people around you, especially the youth, your own children, your grandchildren, nieces, nephews, but also reach out. Maybe you have neighbors or community, like a church youth group, or kids that you see in your neighborhood that are maybe not supervised as much or something like that. Just reach out and educate all of the children, especially around you.
Well, and Amber, you're working hard to raise awareness for moms, mm-hmm. dads, for the people who are at risk as well. What do you wish you could say to 15-year-old Amber, what would you tell her?
I would have definitely told myself not to lose hope. I think it was easier for me because I kept coming into contact with so many people who could have made a change for me. And I think now that's why I'm so eager to just get this out there, because I think awareness is key. I think that if, you know, these small businesses in these communities partner together and see these girls and realize this could be your daughter, you know, your niece, somebody close to you, don't just call the police and say, you know, okay, this is going on in front of this business and, you know, try and extend, you know, a help. Let them know, like, okay, you know, if you need somewhere safe, you can hide out here. You know, we can partner. We partner with these certain nonprofit organizations and reach out to them and let them know I have this girl here. She's in need of help. I think that that would have made a huge difference for me. And I think it's something that the military is very, you know, passionate about educating soldiers on human trafficking and stuff like that. I would love to see more businesses and small businesses take responsibility and do that, too. And even with social media, like, everybody do have their own individual responsibility to bring, you know, awareness and educate themselves. So go follow, you know, your local police department on social media. They have pages and they're always updating, you know, new things that are going on, you know, in this underground world, and realize that at the end of the day, even though it's illegal, it's still a business. So while, you know, the police force and the criminal justice system is evolving, so are they. They are getting smarter, you know, with their tactics and how they're getting women in by even posting wanted ads. So you can make this much money in a week. And if it's too good to be true, sometimes it is. If you see an ad that says, you know, looking for 13 to 16-year-olds, you can make $1,000 in a week and just call this number. Those are 9 times out of 10 trafficking ads. I mean, in some places, they're tying T-shirts around windshield wipers and parking garages. And as soon as they see women, you know, tugging at them to grab them, they go and snatch that woman. So I've seen a lot of that going around on social media, warning them, like, you know, don't play with it. Just get in your car and drive somewhere where it's lit up, you know, a gas station or something, you know, and then report where it happened at. Because there's security cameras a lot of places everywhere now. And I mean, just communicating these certain things, these risk factors, and understanding everybody's at risk. You know, you don't have to be 13, 14. You can be established in your career. You can be a lot older. I mean, it doesn't discriminate. There are older women, young kids, babies. It doesn't discriminate. Mm-hmm.
There was a newspaper article recently about a woman in Des Moines who was shopping at a department store and felt like she was being followed, a man behaving strangely. She spoke to the manager at the store and was escorted to her car and found that her car had been staked out. And, you know, this is an incident that there wasn't actually a crime committed, but she shared her story because she wanted people to know what was going on. I mean, In raising awareness for this, do you try to communicate to people that if things are strange, to ask for help? Because I think a lot of us feel like we're alone out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you see something, say something, even if it's about yourself.
Yeah.
And Amber. I've done that. I was in Walmart not too long ago with my kids, and I felt like there was two men just following us around, going through the bins that had sippy cups in it. And it just looked so odd to me. So I'm on one side of the store. They're there. I'm in the baby area. Now they're there. When I'm checking out, I let the woman know behind the register, and she rung somebody up there who walked me to my car and loaded everything in. I just I'm at Walmart. It's huge. It's a lot of cars, but I just know how easy it is and how this crime in particular happens in broad daylight, right under people's noses. And I wasn't going to take any chances. I'm like, you know, I'm with my kids. I'm going to say something. And they helped me. They walked me out. And I mean, by the time I got home, I kind of was thinking back on it, like, okay, am I overreacting because I've been through this? But I'd rather be safe than sorry.
A lot of us would love to be able to help somebody. The statistics, again, statistics are hard to come by, but the estimate is that only 1 or 2% of the people who are trafficked ever make it out. So, Teresa, how do you, if you suspect something's going on, if you see somebody at a bus station, at a a convenience store, at a hotel that you think is in trouble. I mean, knowing that that person may have been threatened with their life if they ask you for help, what can you do? How could you help?
Yeah, and it is hard because you want to keep yourself safe and you also want to keep the person that is needing help safe. Because you're right, sometimes if they ask you for help, they can be beaten or threatened with their life, et cetera. And so you try to gather the information that you can without endangering yourself or them. But you can always call the National Human Trafficking Hotline. And that number is fairly easy to remember. It's 1-888-373-7888. But I always recommend everyone put that number in their cell phones because at that time you're not going to be able to remember it. And maybe you're in a place without internet and you can't look it up. So just have that in the cell phone. That trafficking hotline actually is your direct link to your local police department, but you can always call the local police department as well. And then there are other avenues and other hotlines in Iowa that you can call as well.
I mentioned hotels, which that's a place where a lot of human trafficking takes place.
Yes.
You're working to educate people who work at hotels. Tell me about your efforts there.
Sure. There's a coalition that started in Nebraska and is now coming to Iowa and going all across Iowa with all of our organizations are trying to partner so that we're sending a research-based similar message to all of the hotels and motels in our state. And so our organization is bringing in the training on September 25th for people who want to volunteer to go train hotel motel staff on what to see, what to look for, what to do if they find something. It's a three-hour training, and from there we'll be contacting hotels and motels. And if the hotel or motel trains at least 80% of their staff, then they get a plaque that accommodates them for being in this fight, as well as, you know, some PR and stuff like that. But, yeah. We're
trying to spread the word.
Yeah.
And Amber mentioned small business owners. I mean, is that an avenue that's really important as far as education and awareness?
It is. In fact, Chains Interrupted has started a coalition that currently has 75 businesses and organizations and individuals that meet quarterly, and we do education as well as networking and trying to come up with get the plan a little bit better established on what to do and who to call and get some teams on the police departments that are specifically trained in this. And
well, Teresa Davidson, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
The president of Chains Interrupted, a Cedar Rapids-based nonprofit working to fight and prevent human trafficking. And Amber Causey, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
It's incredibly brave of you to share your story. And again, the pageant is coming up in October. Mm-hmm. What do you have leading up to the pageant? Are you getting ready?
I am. just mentally preparing myself. It's definitely a lot of work pulling myself out of my comfort zone. And so trying to balance everything too.
Right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. We're also looking forward to your book being published next year. I've been talking with Amber Causey this hour. She is a survivor of human trafficking. She now has a master's degree in criminal justice. She's working on another master's degree, hoping to go to law school, the mother of two great kids. She's also competing to become Miss Veteran America 2017. And her book will be published next year, Redemption for a Stolen Girl. Talk of Iowa is produced at Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. We had production assistance today from Robbie Broad. You can get in touch with us anytime. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can follow us on Twitter. Of course, I'm there as well, @CharityNebbie. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.